Hey, asshole. Do you know what you're listening to? You're listening to the very first episode ever of the Degenerate Life Podcast. And you're probably not an asshole, but that's a good way to get someone's attention by calling them an asshole. I'm your host, producer, and comedian, Devin Penninger. And the intro music you just heard, it's a song called Throwing Up Blood by an acoustic punk duo called Dollar Signs. My friend Eric Button is in that band. They're a great duo that just refuses to play electric instruments, and they write these very funny acoustic songs played with a punk energy. Dollar Signs. Look them up on Bandcamp.com. All right, on today's episode, we have the guest Adam Scorgi, independent filmmaker and producer. He made the film The Union, The Business Behind Getting High. It's wildly popular on Netflix. It's one of the most watched documentaries on there. And it's great because it navigates its way through a lot of the myths about marijuana. I love how his film really tackled the myths of memory loss and talked about false tests that the government did. It's a great film. But we don't just talk about weed. We cover a lot of topics in the interview. I was surprised. I was actually a little nervous about doing it, which sounds silly to say, but I was, because I just don't think I'm that good of an interviewer. And I'm new at this podcasting thing, so I was winging it, basically. But I talked to him on Skype, and I think it went pretty well. I got a whole fucking hour out of it. It was good. So hopefully, if you're into filmmaking, you'll probably find it pretty interesting. Since Adam Scorgi, the guy who made the most popular documentary on weed, is in this episode, it seems fitting that I should play a stand-up clip of me talking about marijuana. So, here that is, and then we'll get into the interview.
I don't know, this country, though, has just been overtaken by laziness. That's another problem with people. Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. Says the laziest guy in the room, right here. Total hypocrite. Very lazy. But they sell t-shirts now. Have you been to Walmart lately? They have t-shirts that say Forever Lazy on them. Forever Lazy. What kind of message are you trying to send out when you wear a shirt that says Forever Lazy? How do you want people to perceive you? Yeah, this is day three of wearing the same pants. Suck on that, people who seize the day. Forever Lazy. Don't fucking wear that. It's horrible. But I'm too lazy. I get depressed and I deal with that by just smoking a lot of weed. You know you're too lazy if you don't even have the ambition to roll the joint. You simply slap the weed on the sandwich and eat it. It's too fucking lazy. I like to get stoned and then watch a Discovery Channel. That's what I like to do. You know, like nature shows, you're nodding your head. Like you look more turned on than anything. It's just disturbing because I know your boyfriend. So you look turned on by just the mere mention of a nature show. I was stoned when I was watching Discovery Channel. They had a special on about frogs in the rainforest. And a thought occurred to me. Frogs and hookers have something in common. When you're done playing with them, either one can be dropped off by a river. Yeah, it's funny because the hooker is dead. Yeah. Here's the thing I don't get. Why pay for sex? I mean, there are free sluts out there. That's the free sluts. Let's say you're the type of guy that you're just going to do that. You're just going to get a hooker. All right, but if you throw all morals and all human decency out the window, you can kill a bitch and keep your money. That is an option. I'm not saying you should do that. I'm just saying it's an option, and I'm surprised more people don't take it. That's all I'm saying. All right, this turned into a weird crime confessional just now.
Announcement about the next Degenerate Production CLT show. The next live show, the headliner is Sarah Schaefer from Late Night with Jimmy Fallon and the podcast You Had to Be There. She does that podcast with my friend Nikki Glazer. Sarah's fucking funny. She's great. And the tickets, they're only $10. You can buy it at the door, or you can go to her Kickstarter page if you want to get a ticket in advance. In an interview she did with Gothamist.com, they asked her, do you have any words of advice for aspiring comedians? She said, first, look around and see what all the other comedians are doing, not just in terms of material, style, etc., but also where they are performing and whose ass they are kissing. Second, ignore all that and go do your own thing. I think that's the best advice someone could give you. I mean, yeah, just kissing ass is not what comedy is about. And sadly, I fucking see a lot of it.
It's sickening how, I don't know, there sure are a lot of people out there prostituting themselves in ways that have nothing to do with sex. The entertainment industry, it's got to be the worst. Just blatant, puckering up, getting deep inside the anal cavity.
We live in a culture where everyone wants to take the easiest route to get to success. And that, sometimes that's not a bad thing. If something's easy, why not do it the easy way? You know, why not? But sometimes it comes at the cost of your dignity. I mean, I think people lose a part of themselves when they start kissing ass to get ahead. It's just, I don't know, it saddens me when you see people change because, oh, they got a gig and they think they're in good with someone. I don't know. You put a booker alone in a room with a comic. That booker could tell the comic that his mother is a cum-chugging whore, and he would agree with him if he thought it would give him a spot, you know, for opening for some big shot. Oh, yes, my mother guzzles gallons of cum. Now tell me, who is opening for Louis C.K. again? It's just ridiculous. Just, no one has their own moral code anymore, it seems. You gotta have your own moral code, people. Music you were just listening to, it's a song called We Were Wild by Today the Moon, Tomorrow the Sun. They're one of my favorite bands. They're based in Atlanta, and they're going to be guests on a later episode of the podcast. But today's guest is Adam Scorgi, independent filmmaker and producer of The Union, the business behind Getting High. So let's go on and get into the interview I recorded yesterday.
1974, the Heath-Tulin Study. Ronald Reagan announces, the most reliable scientific sources say permanent brain damage is one of the inevitable results of the use of marijuana. Monkeys pumped full of marijuana, apparently 30 joints a day, had begun to atrophy and die after 90 days. Brain damage was determined after counting the dead brain cells of both monkeys who had been subjected to the marijuana and ones who had not. This study became the foundation of the government and other special interest groups' claim that marijuana kills brain cells. Here's what they didn't tell you. After 6 years of requests, how the study was conducted was finally revealed. Instead of administering 30 joints a day for 1 year, Dr. Heath used a method of pumping 63 Colombian-strength joints through a gas mask within 5 minutes over 3 months.
They suffocated the monkeys. What they did is they put these gas masks basically on their face and they pumped pot into it, but without additional oxygen. So after X amount of time, the brain shut down. Well, if you suffocate, the first thing that's going to happen is your brain cells are going to die with lack of oxygen. So what they did is they suffocated the monkey, showed all these dead brain cells, and then went on to associate it by saying that cannabis use causes your brain cells to die. And how many people, not knowing the origin of the study, have gone on to quote it and re-quote it. And now people believe it.
Studies since have shown no signs of any brain cell damage. In 2005, new research suggested that marijuana could possibly stimulate brain cell growth. That study hasn't received the same attention.
So what are you doing right now? What are you working on? I mean, I know we're going to talk about the union, but what are you working on right now?
Well, we're working on a follow-up to the union called the Culture High, which we're hoping... We've gotten some commercial interest already with Super Channel, Phase 4 Films, which is the company that did the Canadian release on Kevin Smith's Red State. They now have like a 4-picture deal. And then Hollywood Suites. So we have a gap we have to fill. So we're actually doing something pretty cool. So we're going back to Kickstarter. And we need to hit a gap of $175,000. But in doing so... we will get the Culture High into over 100 theaters in North America and some in Australia and the UK.
That'd be big. That'd be pretty fucking huge. That'd be great.
Yeah. And the cool thing is all they have to do is, it's the first time the audience really gets to decide just how wide the theatrical release is, because the better we do on Kickstarter, the wider we can get the theatrical release to be. And all we're asking people to do is pre-buy a copy of the film.
No, that's great. Kickstarter, I've wanted to use that, but I just wanted to use it as a way to get money into my bank account. They're not for just me not being broke, but if I had an idea, I'd use it. If I had an idea for something like that.
No, that's something I have a lot of people, because I used it once before, similar to that, like, as you know, you're an artist and myself, I'm the same, where just, you know, I needed like $24,000 to do this demo for it was for a project called Ice Guardians about hockey enforcers, right? The guys that fight all the time. And I didn't have money, so I did one that where I raised $24,000 in 60 days. And essentially, I didn't have any one project to officially advertise on there. I just said I had several projects I was trying to do, and I needed help, but still had great support. But the key thing I found with Kickstarter is that people that don't succeed don't treat it like a job. Like when you put a project up there, it's a full-time job reaching your goal. You can't just put it up on the internet and hope that you make your goal, right? Like, oh, I'm just gonna launch this and hopefully all the money comes in. So I noticed a southern draw in your accent. Where are you from?
I'm from North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay, actually I did a screening of the union out there.
Did you?
Yeah, they had like a debates class or something like that, and they treated me first class, flew me out. I went to the university there, the big, I'm not sure if it's the big one. There's one that kind of rivals with it. I can't remember.
There's UNCC. Was that it?
No, I don't think it's a bigger. It's the smaller one. I don't even think it has a football team, but it was a big campus and everything. But yeah, they treated me first class. And you know, I always get weird. I feel like a fraud because I get paid these appearance fees to come out and speak to colleges, and I'm like, I don't know what you want me to say, man. I'm just a filmmaker. Like, I always warn them. I'm like, if you're looking for some like political activist to come out there and, you know, rah 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 about rights and this, I'm like, I'm not the guy. There's guys that are way better than me. And I was like, I'm researched on what we put in the film, obviously, but if you're looking for an activist or some political speaker, I'm not that guy. I kind of feel like a fake when I get these checks out there, but I do appreciate them.
Maybe, I guess, after so many college appearances, it'll feel natural to you. I don't know.
I don't know. I still, because sometimes it gets really weirded out. Like, not so much at the colleges, but I've done other screenings where people will come up and say, like I did one in Modesto, California, and it was actually one of the first podcasts. They had a podcast there, and I jumped on, and some people, they call themselves the Prop 215 Info Center, and they just direct people on how to get a license so they can use medicinal cannabis. And a lot of people that showed up to the screening had cancer and all kinds of illnesses, and they play my film on repeat, like ever since they've opened for like 2 years, right? It's just on repeat every day. So these people on, like the owners and stuff, honestly knew the film like as well as I did. And the kind of people that showed up to the screening, I mean, there was a young girl who was 23 that was a model and she had cancer, and her brother came up to me afterwards and he was in tears and he hugged me and he's like, "You're a hero." And I was like, "Whoa, dude." Like, when I think of a hero, I think of a guy like runs in a burning building and pulls out four kids on his shoulder. And I was like, I'm just a filmmaker. I'm definitely no hero. And then another guy that had an illness is like, well, he's like, to some of us, your film has been what's finally got people to open their mind. And in his case, his brother's sister was not responding well to the pain medications and chemotherapy and everything. And it was my movie that finally got her parents to allow her to use cannabis for the treatment. And she was having tremendous results. Started eating again, started getting color, was feeling much better, wasn't groggy or nauseous all the time. So he's like, in my eyes, you are. And, you know, that really was touching to me and my crew. Like, because we never set out to do that with the union. We didn't think that we were going to, like, move mountains like that. That was not our goal.
It's pretty awesome, though. I mean, you're shining a light on a subject matter that I guess people are desperate for it to be taken seriously, and the government just won't, so.
No, and that's, I think that's why the film turned out well, is because we were just filmmakers that wanted to make a great film, right? So we set out to do that. We didn't have a political agenda, like, hey, we want this to accomplish this or do this. And by not having that agenda and being filmmakers first, we were, and I'm just going by people we interviewed, some of the first people that really sat down and asked good, intelligent questions, because so many of the, like, you know, like Harvard professors or criminologists we interviewed, we're like, finally, like, you guys have, like, written down questions and you guys have full light. Like, they could tell as soon as we came that we were a proper production, right? A kid from his high school class with a video camera, right, that had read about him online.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's why in the past other, you know, cannabis docs or, like, drug war docs haven't come, right, because they've come from people that are just passionate, that want to make a movie to send a political message. And of course we believe everything that's in our film, but that wasn't our goal. Like, we're doing other films that have nothing to do with drugs, right? Even doing a follow-up, we wanted to try to stay away from that, but the industry kept driving us there. And then with everything gone in the media around the globe right now, we're just like, you know what, let's do another one, because we've gotten way better in our skills and what we can deliver. And we've made industry contacts where we can do it right. Like, the union sat for 2 years because we couldn't get a distribution deal, right? Because we didn't know. We made a film, and then we went to film festivals, and we thought, oh, someone will call us to pick it up, right? And yeah, that didn't happen. So,
Why was it hard for those 2 years to get a distribution deal?
Well, because you're an artist, right? You're going to film festivals and you're winning awards, and, like, I didn't know that distributors wouldn't be there. I thought they'd come up and be like, hey, you just won the best documentary. Like, I want to look at representing your film. But as I found out, the buyers for films are only at, like, maybe a handful of markets every year, right? So if you're not in those markets, you're not selling it. And then even then, it's not like they just wander into your film. They're busy looking at hundreds of films when they come there, and everybody's pitching them. So unless you have a contact to invite them to the screening, probably not going to come and see it anyway. Even if it's got buzz and even if it's got everything else, it's, you know, unless they're invited. So, you know, you have, as a filmmaker, you have no clue how your film, like, you've made a film and you're like, here I go, I made this film, proud of it, but you have no idea how to get it out into the market.
Yeah.
Right? And then, you know, but I just refused. I borrowed an incredible amount of money from my stepdad, and I wasn't about to just hang him out to dry. So I just found a way. I went on IMDb and I saw other documentaries that I thought ours was just as good as, and I was like, okay, who reps those films? Look, okay, I'll send them an email and I'll pitch to them and go to them. And then just by chance, my accountant had grew up his childhood friend from a small town here called Vernon. He's like, oh yeah, he's like, you should meet my friend. He goes to Cannes and MIP and Sundance and all the big festivals every year. You guys should talk, see if there can be some synergy there. And I was, sure, I didn't even know what he did. And he was a sales agent, thank God, right? So he was the one that helped me with contracts. And so, and we just built a friendship. He helped me for a good 6 to 8 months before he even officially became my sales agent. And then now he's one of my closest friends, and I get advice from him on everything, and I just make him my sales agent on everything as well.
That's weird how, like, the connections you wouldn't think would, oh, this guy can help me out with something. You wouldn't think that stuff pans out that way. It just does sometimes.
No, and that's why I try to be as accessible as possible by Facebook and everything else, because I'm hoping maybe I can help other young people in their careers so they don't have to make some of the mistakes I made. Or even now, like, because I had to do everything, like, we didn't have money for marketing, we didn't have money for publicists, we didn't have, like, that was all us. Like, when you see comments on the union page, that's me, right? There's no one. I don't have an account rep that does that for me. That's me trying to put all those new articles up there and comments and posts and trying to keep it interactive. And through the way, I've built relationships with a lot of media people. And I was just talking to actually Fearless Fred is his name. He's a host of one of the biggest radio stations in Toronto. And me and him stayed friends and connected from the union, because he'd always promote my stuff as he was climbing up as a, you know, a radio jockey, right, through the year. So it was pretty cool, because I was showing him some of my work recently, and he was like, dude, he's like, you have become one fucking talented filmmaker. And I was like, dude, you're like one of the biggest radio DJs in Canada. Like, it's weird that we both kind of grew, and now we always support each other whenever we can.
That's pretty awesome. How'd you decide to make a documentary about marijuana? Like, did you have, like, a handful of things you wanted to make a doc on? How'd you settle on that topic?
No, I never thought I would do a doc. It was just, I was in New York going to acting school, because I originally wanted to be an actor and in the film industry, and I just finished my 3-year conservatory at the William Esper Studios, which is a pretty renowned acting studio in New York. And then I came back, because my father had passed away, my real dad had passed away, and I came back and I took over his estate here in Kelowna, BC, Canada, and which he owned a strip club that I inherited, and it was a nightmare. And when I came back, I had a lot of friends that, or acquaintances that I went to high school with, that were now really, really well off, and they had beautiful boats and like $60,000 trucks and like $80,000 Harleys. And I was like, man, I was like, what has he been up to? And the joke, what people would tell me, they're like, dude, you don't know what so-and-so does? He's in the union. I'm like, what, the union pays good? What is that? What union? No, like, yeah. Hey, dude, he grows dope. That's the code name we say here. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, I looked at seriously at getting into it, because I was like, man, if these guys, they've been doing it for, like, I've been gone for 5 years. They've been doing it the whole time. And I was like, man, if I could do it for a few years, grow, make a lot of money, I'd go back to New York. I'd work on, I'd pursue my acting career, come back every 3 months, collect a big briefcase, and use that money to fund my career. But, you know, and then that's when I kind of saw how there's a whole sub-industry that supports it, because our realtor, when I go looking for houses, the guy that I was looking to buy a house with, he'd be like, oh yeah, and just so you notice, like, you got extra amperage on this block, and you have secluded, no neighbors, it's a perfect bi-level house. And I was like, why are you telling me that? He's like, oh, just thought you'd want to know. Right? Like, yeah. And I was like, and then, like, we confessed, like, after we looked at a few more houses, he's like, listen, man, he's like, I've shown so many houses that I know exactly when someone's looking to sub the basement to grow. He's like, I've almost wanted to make a business card saying that if you're growing, I'm showing, right? Like, because it's not illegal to sell a house. Yeah. If you're growing it, that's up to you, right? He's just selling you a house. So he's like, I'm not doing anything illegal. What you do with it afterward, that's up to you.
At worst, he's an enabler, but it's legal to be an enabler, so.
Yeah, so I felt like my father looking down on me. So then I was like, man, it's so weird how this whole industry works, right? How, like, and then there's mortgage brokers who will help you if you have bad credit and use cash, and there's guys that help the growers all the time, so you can go to them, and then there's certain banks you can go to, and there's like a phone call for everyone that'll help put this money through, right, if you have money. So that's when I thought, I was like, man, there's never been a really good documentary about this that explains all this stuff. Like, and I was like, I hate to put my 3 years, you know, or 4 years in New York to waste. And I just felt like my father was looking down on me. disappointed if I went, you know, in the illegal direction. So I was like, man, I'm going to make a documentary on this.
You said you inherited a strip club. I just find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, I did. I inherited it was called Cheetah's. Cheetah's Show Lounge in Kelowna. Yeah, I inherited that nightmare. That was the worst thing. I couldn't wait to get rid of that. And I'm actually doing a screenplay on that about inheriting a strip club and growing up around the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club in my town. My dad was good friends with a lot of them. And, you know, that's how I kind of saw the angle of the union from a different perspective, because I saw, you know, smugglers and stuff that were doing this for years. And, you know, a lot of the smugglers, they wanted penalties to get stiffer. They wanted the government to make things like, oh, man, you know, when we were back in the heydays in the late, you know, in the early 90s, they were making a killing because the U.S. dollar is 55 cents on the dollar. And they were getting like $3,500 for a pound of bud. $3,500 U.S., it turned out to be like $5,500 Canadian. You know, now they're lucky to get 16 to 18, maybe 2,000. So they're making three times the money they're making now. And there's hardly anybody doing it. So even now you talk to them, with Harper here in Canada, our prime minister, he's looking at putting mandatory minimums for cultivation. And all the growers were stoked about that, right? The real, you know, the mom pa's or the few people that were growing, you know, maybe 10 to 20 grand a year, one room in their basement, doing just five lights, that'll knock them out of it. But yeah, organized crime is already willing to take that risk. You know, when you have that mindset for organized crime, the fastest way to reach your goal of getting rich is the only thing that they connect with, right? So if you make the penalty stiffer, it's like the guy says in my movie, he's like, good, you make the penalty stiffer, those aren't getting caught, make more money, right? It's yeah. Like, that's how they think about it. They don't, I know a few of them that they're stoked about the mandatory minimums. They're like, yes, this will knock out all the mom paws and all the young guys, and fuck, we can go back to making more money.
Make it easier for them to monopolize an area too, I guess.
Like. Yeah, there's less competition, right? It's like any business, right? If you're on a street with 20 coffee shops, you're not going to make as much as if you're the only one.
Yeah. I never even knew that shit got that complicated until I saw that documentary. I mean, it's like that mob mentality you're talking about. I figured it'd just be, you know, just local kids and shit selling weed, and I didn't know it got that deep with weed. Coke, sure, but you know. I don't know.
Man, trust me, our exploration into this got, we never knew it got that deep, right? But if you'd interview guys like the former police chief of Seattle, or, you know, Lester Grinspoon, who's, you know, who has studied, the first Ivy League doctor to come out with the real results of all the medical studies done on cannabis, like, you sit down with them for 2 hours and listen to what they've learned over their 30 years of being involved in this argument, and your world is turned upside down. I remember literally coming out of certain interviews and being like, I can't look at anything the same. Like, I couldn't read a newspaper article the same way without being like, oh, that's what that journalist's agenda is. Like, he's trying to get front page, so he's writing about this in a certain way, right? And, like, it's way off on, like, it just was bizarre. Like, it literally, I remember some nights I couldn't sleep because my mind was rolling so much. I'm just like, man, like, what is this film going to turn into? Because we don't even, like, we're learning way more than we ever expected, right? Like,
yeah.
That's why you could have almost turned it into a miniseries, right? The film, like, there's just so much information within that 2 hour period that the film is, that some people find it a little too overwhelming, right? You almost have to watch it two or three times to really pick up all the stats and information we put in there.
Yeah, the first time I watched it, I missed this thing where you're talking about private prisons, and then I didn't catch that till the second time. There's just, like, a lot of stuff in it I missed, and like the thing that stuck with me though was the testing on monkeys.
Became the foundation for everybody's, and you still hear people using it today, like Sheriff Baca or whatever, California State Police Chief, or Police Chief of California or Los Angeles, but he still makes that thing, being like, well, listen, if you want to make yourself dumber and smoke weed, just stay in your house and make yourself dumber. But nothing kills more brain cells than alcohol.
Yeah.
Like, look at people when they're under the, I used to own a nightclub, right? I saw it. I inherited that mess. I saw what people are like on booze. There's no more destructive thing. I've seen young guys want to fight gangsters because they think they're invincible all of a sudden, and they get pounded to within an inch of their life. I see guys all of a sudden just just totally out of their mind, just go up a girl's shirt, go up a girl's skirt. Like, guys are, I remember having this conversation, I was telling this at work the other day, a million times. We would walk a guy out politely, right? And be like, hey man, you've had too much tonight, here's a cab for you, we called it, you're done for tonight, but you know, you can come back tomorrow, I'll even take care of your cover if you come back tomorrow. But tonight, you've had too much and you're done. Right? And they'll walk out and they'll be peaceful and they're like, okay, man. They're like, but why did I get thrown out? They're like, 'cause you're drunk. You're wasted. Yeah. They're like, yeah, but it's a fucking bar. And you're like, yeah, where you're allowed to drink but not get wasted. Right? Yeah. That's the rules of a bar. Oh, that's, no, it's not. How many other people are wasted? I'm like, listen, everybody gets a little tipsy, but when you're stumbling and bumping into people, it's too much. I'm like, fine, fine. And then literally they turn away for a second to look at something else happening. They come back and the whole conversation starts again. They forget. Why did I get thrown out, man? Well, dude, because we just went through this. Like, you're too drunk. It's a bar. No, I'm like, dude, this is seriously. And then they start getting aggressive because you're being polite. And they're like, well, but I just fucking punch you in the head. And it's like, seriously, man, they didn't put me on the door because I'm a wimp. Right, they put me on the door because I know how to handle things, but I'll do it professionally, try to get you home safe. But trust me, if you come at me in an aggressive way, there's me and a crew, we will take care of things, right? Like,
yeah.
And the guy's still like, and then you see them clenching their fist and they're trying to sucker. Like, it just, the mind is just like, I get so frustrated with some people. When you're younger, you have more patience. As you're older and you get jaded, and I really hated the nightclub business. Like, I hated that when people go through. I'd even say to my other my watch, I just went through this with him. He's going to look away because he's having a smoke. He's going to look back and he's going to go through it all over with me again. Like, he totally out of his mind. Yeah. Where did we kick out, man? I hate serving alcohol is a ticking time bomb. Man, you put 300 drunk people in a room, bottles get smashed. I've had doormen stabbed. Like, it's bad.
I used but to have a...
That being said, I still think it's way better that at least the government's trying to control it. You're in a regulated establishment. You have doormen in place. You have things in place to control things, because I thought about it on certain nights when I'd see a big fight happen out front of the bar and some drunk guys would get beat up bad, right? And we'd call an ambulance. Now, I put into my head, I was like, wow, like if we were in a legal club and my owner was worried about going to jail for selling an illegal substance, we probably not help those people. We wouldn't call an ambulance. We'd be like, go throw them in the dumpster up the street.
Yeah.
Right? And hopefully somebody finds them. Right? And that's what happens in a black market, is it gets pushed under the table, right? Where people want to do something. It's something that they, you know, that they don't obey, and then someone's going to take control over it. And that's, unfortunately, what happens with substances that are in big demand.
Plus it drives the value up, the street value, I guess. So it's, I just find it weird that alcohol, though, it's like there's this weird respect that the government gives it when it's so much of a problem.
Yeah, it is funny that way, especially where it's so accepted, like in sports. You know, I'm blown away by that because I look at the whole, I look at them as all drugs. And it's funny because I had some girl on Twitter the other day, someone was promoting my film, and she's like, well, that's smart, encourage people to smoke weed and get stupid, right? And I was just like, or to do drugs. And I was like, well, lots of people do drugs, not just people that smoke weed, people that drink caffeine, people that drink booze, people that, and she's like, I said drugs. And I was like, yeah, so did I.
Yeah.
Right? And she's like, booze is not a drug. And I was like, I didn't want to argue with her after that, right? I was just like, if you look up the definition of drug in a dictionary, 100% it is a drug. Oh, or you want to get the damage it does to your body or anything like that. And yet, you look at all the pro sports, what's their biggest sponsor? It's like alcohol. It's like, you know, UFC, the king of beers, NFL, Bud Light, NHL, Coors Light. Like, it's cool to market in those establishments, right? And have, and then even the ads, like some of the ads I look at are like, it's like, oh, you get laid by sexy chicks if you drink Captain Morgan's. That's what the commercial tells me, right? Like, no wonder people want to do that stuff. Like, I just saw a commercial where these guys drink Cap Morgans and three hot chicks come up to them and say, hey. You know, like.
Yeah. And in reality, that guy just usually says something abhorrent to them and then they walk away. But, yeah, in the commercial, he's the fucking man.
He's the man. Man, and only because he's drinking Captain Morgans.
Yeah, it has to be specifically Captain Morgans or else, you know, those women are just going to blow him off.
It's, yeah, it is pretty funny.
I'll find the phrase, like, in a lot of commercials, they'll say, please drink responsibly. But it's kind of easier said than done, because it creates a habit that just breeds irresponsibility. I mean...
Well, I think so, too, and it's something that, you know, a lot of people have talked about when you look at, like, the European relationship, where, like, in Italy and stuff, you know, kids can have, at a restaurant at 12 years old, they can have a glass of wine with their parents, right? So they learn to appreciate booze. Like, I remember when I went to Italy, I was, like, 17, and we were at a restaurant, and these kids looked, like, 10, and they had wine, and they had it in a glass like this, and they're sifting it and sniffing it and sipping it gently where they're having this... I was like, Mom, that kid's got to be 10. And they're like, yeah, but here in Italy, it's exciting. They're like, if you wanted to get a glass of wine, they'd let you too. And, you know, but the U.S. is like so restricted. It's like, no, no, no. And then you're 21 and give her, right? And then it's like, it's beer parties and slam and, you know.
They've waited so long that it's just, they're ready to just go overboard with it.
To get loose. And And where instead of, if you know, you were educated for your first few times drinking with your parents, if it wasn't taboo, it's like, here, you want to have a beer or two? Let's watch the game. See how you feel, right? You feel a little tipsy. See how that feels. Now, if you were to have one or two more, you'd probably get sick. You could do something stupid. This is where you got to learn, like, that's where your body's saying stop.
Yeah.
Right? I always compare it to, like, a poison, right? Like, think if you were to accidentally eat a poisonous mushroom, first thing that's going to go is, like, your balance and speech, right? You're going to be like, whoa, things are off, right? I don't feel right. And then, of course, you get dizzy, you don't feel good. All the things booze does to you.
Yeah.
It's literally poison when you drink it. It has the same effects as...
Well, they do call it alcohol poisoning, too. So.
Yeah, exactly.
I had that on my 21st birthday. So it's kind of like what you were talking about, how you wait so long, then you're 21, and it's all right, and then you just do a ridiculous amount.
Yeah, and you just give her to your, you know, like, yeah, like you're getting your stomach pumped, right? Because you've had way too much.
I woke up on a balcony wearing only my underpants, just covered in vomit. It was weird.
Yeah, see, and those are nights, like, that's where, like, my bachelor party, because I rarely drink, right? It's maybe a few times a year. Like, even we, you know, we'll have guests over and everybody's having wine and stuff. I'll have a pop. That's my advice. I drink way too much soda. But, yeah, I mean, I've never been a drinker, so, and it was because my dad, like, owning a nightclub, my dad was always like, you guys want to drink? Fine. Have two of your friends over. I'll buy you guys a case of beer, but you guys stay home.
Yeah.
Right? And I'll let you guys drink. And then it was kind of like took away the whole thrill, and I was like, well, I can drink any time. That's kind of boring. Right? Like, it's like, you know, my dad always said, go ahead, but, you know, I'll get it for you, and I want to know where you're going to be, because fights and everything else, right? And then I used to box, and, you know, I don't know, I never was big into it. And that's, everyone's always surprised, too, when they find out I don't smoke weed regularly, too. Everybody's like, that's ludicrous, right? And I was like, I'm a filmmaker, right? I'm not saying I haven't tried it, and I'm not saying, you know, I don't occasionally smoke. Like, special occasions, you know, if I see a friend I haven't seen in a long time, we're up at a cabin or something like that, I much prefer it over having booze, because, like, just last week I drank for the first time and... Oh, like 4 or 5 months, and man, I didn't even have too much, maybe 6-7 drinks, and I felt like death the next day.
Yeah.
Like, my daughter's like, Dad, can we go to the park? And I'm like, no, how about we just watch playoff hockey today, sweetie?
Yeah, the sun's out. I'm not ready for the world.
Yeah, I'm not really feeling good. Let's just, how about we just, you know, watch some playoff hockey?
I had to quit drinking. It became a problem for me. I have problems with depression, and that just kind of exaggerated everything. But I found that weed, even though I don't smoke weed every day, but I found that helps. So I just find it alarming that it's, that politicians aren't even open to legalizing it. So many just aren't, they won't even hear of it.
Well, I think part of it is, and it's a very small clip in the union, but Todd McCormick says it very well, where he's like, I don't think that, you know, a lot of people think it's like a big conspiracy and all this, and I don't ever get caught up into that stuff. But what I do think is, like, you know, it's like when you go to your job that you go to from Monday to Friday, like, you know, unless you love it and it's your dream job, you're usually doing just enough to meet your quotas or do what has to get done in a day to get out of there.
Yeah.
Right. Like, unless you're really looking for that promotion and you love, like, in film, I'll work 2 days straight if I have to on a project because I love it.
Yeah.
Right? But when I go to even a sales job that's, you know, results oriented, like, as soon as I'm rate getting above the pack, I just let off the burners, right? I'm like, ah, yeah. You know, like, I don't get too carried away, you know, right? Like, and I think it's the same in politics, right? Like, people are, they're going up to get, you know, they're rising up to try to get in to win office or get promoted and become governor and everything else, and they have political platforms and everybody has to buy into a program, and, you know, and then, you know, someone brings up the marijuana thing and that's not part of their thing, so they're not going to take all the time to do the research to have good arguments, so they're just going to be like, get one of their assistants, like, pull me up some arguments for this, right?
And yeah.
It's going to be like, oh, it makes you stupid, it's a gateway drug, and it's people are addicted, you know? And that's, they spit the same stuff, and that's why now when you look at how the Heath Tulin study, the monkey study, how that was like, really, when I think about it now, like, that's what presidents were telling a nation was true.
Yeah, it's like insane.
The person that's supposed to run your country, that's what he said was true.
Yeah, he's basing his info on lies he's not even willing to question.
Like, when you look at that old, that footage of Reagan, right, and that's not that long ago. Like, we're not talking, like, the 50s here. We're talking, like, the 70s and 80s, right, when Reagan came in. That he was saying, you know, and I'm surprised that this research hasn't come to the media and the media have been more prevalent, that this could be the most dangerous drug that is in use in our society today. You know, and people were cheering, like, they believe, like, you know, our president just said that and he has genuine information,
yeah.
Right? You're like, that has to be, but back then there was no internet. Like, who was going to contact all the universities in a nation to be like, hey, have you actually done a medical report on this substance? Oh, you have? Could you send it over so I can validate, like, what your hypothesis and your scientific experiment came out to? That's what Lester Grinspoon in our film did, the Ivy League scholar from Harvard. Because he actually went to, it was partly two reasons, which is an amazing story. One is that his son got leukemia at, like, 12 years old. And his son was having really, really negative effects to all the chemo. I guess you're 12. They're giving you opiates and all this stuff for pain and the chemo and the radiation, like, wasn't eating, was getting deathly ill, super slim. So another doctor said, hey, there's been some studies about using cannabis. And Lester was like, there's no way I'm going to get my kid at 12 years old to smoke cannabis. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Right? And then he started looking into the literature, and he wanted to prove also his good friend Carl Sagan, revolutionary rocket scientist, you know, that wrote the book Contact and is still... You know, he's been a fundamentalist in some of the, you know, NASA research even today, that Carl Sagan smoked four joints a day, went to NASA, and he wanted to prove to him how bad that was for him. Right? He's like, I'm telling you, that shit's going to kill you. That Carl, you can't be doing that. And Carl was like, oh, Lester, you're too uptight. Don't worry about it. It's no big deal. So Lester started to pull all the medical research from all the different Ivy League schools to find out what was on. And the Nixon report was in there, or the Schaefer report that we talk about, and it was nothing that was told in the media. It was completely opposite.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, people even say, like, hey, if you don't believe what the film, like, go get the Schaefer report. It's online. Read what a Republican governor, you know, he wrote what came back from the scientific results, and it wasn't. So Lester wrote a book called Marijuana Reconsidered. Then major flack for that. Harvard wanted to sue him because they were an Ivy League school, and he was talking about, he got nasty.
Did they get anywhere of trying to sue him, or not really?
No, they didn't get anywhere, no. Then it's amazing what that man has accomplished. You could do a short documentary just on him. Then he was a witness for John Lennon, when John Lennon, they were trying to kick him out of the country for hashish. And, he went on trial in the federal court in Massachusetts to testify his studies on what he found on cannabis research. And
hey, for any listeners who haven't seen the documentary, could you explain, like, the truth in what was found in the monkey test? Like, basically, they tested it on monkeys, and they claimed, oh, it kills their brain cells. But in reality, what happened?
Well, what they did is they put, it was the equivalent of 62 Colombian-strength joints through a gas mask in, like, a minute or something like that. I can't remember the exact numbered, but they did it without giving additional oxygen. So if you put carcinogens of any nature in through a gas mask on your face without additional oxygen, well, you suffocate. And then you suffocate, your brain starts to die. And just like when you, and in the film, we put the lifeguard thing, like if you drown, right, or suffocate for more than 2 minutes, you start, the brain starts to die. And then they like suffocated these monkeys and then went on to contribute and be like, you know, because once they pulled off the gas mask, I'm sure a lot of them like resuscitated and came back, and then they're like, oh, look at their brain cells. And well, the brain started to die. It was like, yeah, because you suffocated them. You almost killed them. Yeah. Right? You give them additional oxygen. Plus, when you look at how those studies, like, I mean, what wasn't mentioned in the film is like, okay, well, were you burning them with papers? How were you lighting them? Was there chemicals on there? What was in the tubes that were coming? There's a lot of other things that can get harmful materials that could have gone into that as well. It's a ridiculous study that that's what was used, and all those things that it shows brain cells die was from this ridiculous monkey study that other scientists wanted to see, just as scientists, right? The whole point of science is to determine with logic if that is what happened. And other scientists just are like, oh, great, let me see the study. And it was hidden for a long time. And then finally, when it came out, it had a whole shot through it, but never went very mainstream.
When did it finally come out?
It had been in books like The Emperor Wears No Clothes and stuff like that. I think the Union is what really brought it to light, right? Where a lot of people were like, oh my God, I can't believe that what I was hearing in DARE programs and presidents saying and scientists and doctors was from this ridiculous study that was never backed up with any genuine information.
Yeah, I remember the DARE programs. It was really weird. Even then, at that age, I thought, well, this is just kind of weird how they were trying to really hit that home. You're going to be an idiot if you smoke this stuff.
I didn't. I'll tell you, as a kid, I was like, oh, yeah, they're idiots. You do drugs. You're an idiot. I bought right into it. I was like, oh, yeah, that's bad.
Yeah.
It was going into the film that I'd look at these, especially me. I owned a nightclub at the time when I started production. I would serve people one of the worst drugs around. Yeah. And I would see it on a nightly basis. I'd see fights. I would see viciousness. I'd see people cheat on their significant others. Like, I'd see all that all the time. It was a nightmare in there. And I was like, wow, here I am pointing the finger. And especially where I grew up, where you had a lot of growers spend a lot of money in your bar. You know, I was like, how can I point the finger at them and say, ooh, he's a bad person, he's a drug dealer, but I have no problem accepting his $700 when he wants to ring up a big tab that he's paying for in cash with his drug money? Because I'm like, well, I'm being legal, so it shouldn't matter where his money comes from. No, if you want to be on your high horse and point the finger and say I'm right and you're wrong, then you should say, you know what, I'm not going to serve you because I know your money's not legit.
Yeah.
Right? But what business does that? Not even Wachovia Banks, apparently, because they just got nailed for laundering all that money from down below. And they got nothing. They got a slap on the wrist and a fine.
Yeah.
Like, no jail time, no nothing. That's major fraud. And it's like, oh, you bad boy. Go do some more.
I find it scary that, like, weed remains illegal, but the shit that the FDA is able to put out. Like, even Adderall is as widely accepted as that is, and maybe some people need that, but it's, I don't know how accurate this is, but this is what I read in some journal, that there's a 3% molecular difference between Adderall and cocaine.
It's so bad for you. And it's funny, because I remember when I first went to Texas, I'd never been very good at school, because I'm sure I have some form of ADD. I was diagnosed then that I did, but the test was so ridiculous. It was like no blood test, no kidney test. I filled out a piece of paper and went, it was like, do you get bored when the subject is not interesting? Yeah. Do you tap a pencil when doing tests and chew on things and fidget? I was like, yes. Like, it was like, yes to everything. I'm like, these are stupid questions.
Yeah, that's the majority of people.
And then the guy just looked at it for like 2 seconds and was like, oh yeah, you have ADD. So we'll get you on Adderall and, you know, just start at half the dose. And if you find that you're having trouble sleeping, reduce the dose. And this is when I was really big into working out, like before I worked for Men's Health Magazine and stuff. And I remember asking the doctor, I'm like, well, what exactly is in Adderall that's raising my resting heart rate? And he was like, well, I never said it would do that. And I was like, no, but you said I might have irregular sleeps, and that's from an irregular heartbeat. That's why you can't sleep, is because your heart rate is elevated from a resting state. And he was like looking at me like, holy shit, how does this young guy know this? I was only 19 at the time. And and he was like, oh well, Adderall is like, it's got a stimulant in it, and yeah, like it's you know, a derivative almost of cocaine. Exactly. It's incredible. And the fact that that's given to children as young as it is, and one of the side effects, it's rare, as you mentioned, the film, like, your kid can take that and instantly die. You know, they can have an allergic reaction and die. And it's like, wow, like, you're willing to put your kid... And when I worked in it, at, I used to manage an Abercrombie there, I swear 50% of the young guys that, and girls that worked for me took that. And I remember them, and I'm like, I don't think, I bet you more than half didn't need it, right? They got slightly unfocused in school because high school's fucking boring. You have to learn all this shit that you're never going to use again and follow this... you know, hierarchy system of if you don't do this and you fail and you won't succeed in life. And I remember kids literally coming to me like, sorry, Adam, if I seem a little off at work today, I didn't take my Adderall. And I'm like, dude, you've been fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. They're like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah. I was like, I would just get off of that shit completely.
Yeah, it's like the FDA and just doctors, they're brainwashing them into thinking they're not normal just from the start. Before they've even really had the chance to find out who they are as a person, they're told... Oh, you got something fucking wrong with you.
Take yeah, because you don't fit into this stupid thing that's called high school. That's such an archaic system as it is. Yeah. I've listened to some real big think tanks talk about like how really, like nowadays with the technology we have, you should just have an avatar on a computer that you spend 2 weeks totally designing your learning abilities and your tics. Like if you're a visual learner, then your avatar will constantly use videos and sounds and stuff to get your information versus just a talking head in school, you know, a teacher that's just reading out of a textbook, being like, okay, so the Romans conquered the Gauls and test on this next week, right? Yeah. Read your book. Not everybody learns that way. And I learned, perfect example of that is that, I mean, I was a horrible, horrible high school student. I barely graduated. And I remember teachers telling me like, oh, you're going to be in prison or, you know, a bum by the time you're 24 years old. You know, and I think I've done all right since then. So, yeah. And if I want to stay focused, like when I'm working on the union or one of my film projects, no problem. I can be dead focused, right? But yeah, when I'm trying to learn something that doesn't interest me and I can't apply it to my real life, then I lose focus really fast.
But see, yeah, that's perfectly normal though. If something's not interesting, boredom is the natural reaction. It'd be weirder if someone was like, oh, that's fucking great, by something that's very mundane.
No, well, that's why when I was doing this test to see if I should take Adderall or not, without a blood test or kidney test or anything, like, and it was just like, do you get bored when subject matter is uninteresting? I was like, well, who the fuck doesn't? Yeah. Like, I was, what kind of question is that? Well, first, like, no, I focus harder when it's boring. I'm going to get into it. Like, it is bizarre, and the more I sit back and see after the research we did, like, and same with, like, I mean, I don't know, I mean, you're from Carolina. I mean, you guys, the Hurricanes got a good ad, but hockey's huge here in Canada, right? It's yeah. Like, ball down there. It's our religion. And, I mean, you're seeing a lot of athletes. I had a good friend of mine, Derek Bougard, that was the tough guy for the New York Rangers. You know, he died from Oxycontin and alcohol mixture, right? He started taking Oxycontins because he was an enforcer where they have to fight and they get concussions and they break their knuckles and he had several shoulder injuries and... You know, so he was given by the doctor, like, here's your pain medication, right? And, yeah, he got addicted because oxys are, like, one derivative away from heroin. And I know so many people that got hooked on those and had to go into methadone and treatment clinics simply because they had an injury. Like, they, you know, broke their femur and were in a cast and had to take it, or they got into a biking accident. And they had no idea when the doctor said, hey, take these for pain.
Yeah.
Right? And they got severely addicted. So it blows my mind sometimes to see that, you know, people will, and then you'll have people just freak out when you suggest that, well, hey, you know, cannabis is a great source for pain med, and they're like, no, what, never, that's, you're stupid for suggesting that. I'm like, have you Googled what's in these fucking pills you're taking?
Yeah.
Seriously. I just lost a friend of mine to that shit, right? He went out drinking. You know, he's been taking them for years, so you think you can handle them. He had too much to drink that night. Boom, his heart stopped, right? Like, and he was 6'7", 270 pounds. This is a huge man, right? But that's what happens when you're taking fucking highly toxic pharmaceuticals, right, for pain. And trust me, I had several of these guys that I was friends with, because I'm trying to do another documentary on that, of a lot of these tough guys and athletes that have all kinds of pain and they get addicted to painkillers. They would love to be able to have the opportunity to use cannabis as an alternative for pain.
Yeah.
But all the professional sports leagues say, no, 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 can't do that. You'll fail your drug test.
Who was that NFL player who he became kind of infamous, or I don't know if that's the right word for it, but he became like really well known as just this advocate of pot, and then he couldn't play anymore. He decided, Ricky.
Yeah, Ricky Williams, big, probably one of the best running backs in the last decade.
Didn't he choose pot for a while over being in the NFL, I think?
Yeah, he did. Kind of like as a statement to be, fuck you.
Yeah. And,
well, then you look, hey, the best running back of all time, Walter Payton, Gary Payton. I'm not the huge, but my brother showed me an article all about him, how, man, he almost, like, he almost did, like, 3 attempted suicides. He was addicted to painkillers for, like, 10 years. Right? Like, it's playing professional sports is hard on your body. And that's why those guys get paid big money. And to have alternatives for pain for them is ridiculous to me that, oh, it's either opium or opium. Right? You can have Percocets, Oxycontins, T3s. They're not going to work very well for you. Like, I had a friend of mine that played college ball in Colorado, and he had too many concussions, had to quit, and he was having a lot of symptoms with his concussions. And you know, a lot of the time, morphine can make you really nauseous. That's what it does for me. That's why, luckily, I've had a few injuries, like broken jaw, and I've had my nose fixed from boxing. So I had it shattered a couple times. That I never connected with opiates. They made me really sick, really nauseous, dizzy. The room was spinning. I hated them. Couldn't do them. They weren't for me. Right? So just luckily, I would take them, like, after I just had my nose fixed last summer so I could breathe. And I took the painkillers for one day, and I stopped, and then I felt great. Everybody said after I had the surgery, oh, it knocks you out for like a week.
Yeah.
As soon as I got off the painkillers, I felt fantastic. Everybody's like, man, why do you deal with the pain? I was like, the pain is a million times better than feeling nauseous, flu-like, sick. Like, I hate that feeling.
And then you'd have to go through the withdrawal from them.
Oh, well, that's why I only ever took it for one day. Yeah. Like, I had a... It's even when I had when I broke my jaw, I had liquid morphine, and they said, oh, take this over the next 2 weeks. I took it for one day and said, screw it, I hated it. I'll stay sober instead.
I'm going to have to go in a little bit. I want to ask you something about boxing, because I find that interesting. How do you get used to getting hit, like in the face and shit? How do you prepare yourself mentally for that?
Yeah.
Can you?
It's weird, because one of the things you do in boxing is that you learn to call... But looking through your eyebrows, right? So you tuck your chin in like this, right? So your chin's not exposed, and it seems like you're looking up through your eyebrows, right? So it kind of braces your neck and everything for impact. And it's like anything else, you do it enough, and the first time you get tagged hard in the nose in the ring, fuck, you're like, oh my god, your eyes start watering and like bleeds, and just like, oh my god, that hurts so bad. But it's like anything else, you start deadening the nerve endings and stuff like that, right? And it become accustomed to it, and a lot of it is panicking, because a lot of the time a punch hurts your ego more than it really physically hurts you, right? Like, if you look at all the, like, I don't know how many fights you've seen, but I've seen hundreds on the street, that I see a lot of people that'll hold their face and this and that, but really ask them, like, what happened later? It's, they got some bruises and some swelling. Sure, definitely not saying. There's some big powerhouses I've seen shatter jaws and break nose and a cheekbone and stuff like that, but honestly, when you get that big of a shot, it usually just puts you right to sleep, right? So then you wake up, and then you're in pain. And
so most of it's mental, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of it's just mental. It's like anything else. It's like any sport or anything. Like, when you go to do stand-up, people ask, like, man, how do you handle being in front of a whole crowd and not panicking, right? And if there wasn't a little bit of, like, your heart rate getting excited, then you wouldn't do it anymore. There is some excitement there. But you learn over years how to embrace that and you know, just breathe and control a room and learn that you're not going to win them all. And sometimes you're going to go up there and just eat shit, right? That's going to happen. Right? Same in the ring. You're going to have days when you're not at your best. And man, this guy's just tagging you, right? So then you got to go back to your training, learn to defend and block. And
you're learning how to feed off of an adrenaline rush without giving in to the panic, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. See, I would think that it would just basically just be a lot of enduring the physical pain. I didn't think that a lot of it could be just mental.
Oh, I think way more of it's mental. I mean, I have a, I don't know if I built it over, but I have a high pain threshold. So the pain is never, like I said, I don't even usually use painkillers when I've had surgeries and stuff. I hate them. I just get off of them right away. But I think it's mental. It's probably just because I don't want to be sick and laying in bed. So I'm like, I hate that feeling. I'd rather get up and deal with some pain. And pain's temporary, unless you're like chronic pain, have a terminal illness. But I mean, it's temporary. You heal.
Yeah.
Right? I've had my jaw broken in three places. I had it shattered completely in a bar fight in Edmonton. I had it split where a big fight happened in front of the bar, and some guys came after me and my cousin, and we didn't know what group was group what, so we were fighting everybody but each other. And I don't know, it was like the third guy that I started to tussle with, some guy just lined me up from the side, and hardest I've been hit to date. And I remember, it's the only time I fell to a knee in, I fell to a knee once in the ring, but it was really quick. I was up on a two count. It was more of a stun shot, but this one rocked me where I was like, well, if I take one or two more of those, I will be sleeping. And I just tucked myself into the other guy that I was fighting and got my balance, and then turned around and then we squared up. And luckily the guy had broken his hand, or he dislocated his shoulder or something, because he was like, I can't fight anymore. And I was like, yeah, I feel pretty good too, man. And then my mouth was bleeding so bad. I had this huge gash right here, and I thought he knocked a tooth out. So I flew home from Edmonton to Kelowna the next day, and man, it was killing. I couldn't eat breakfast. My cousin had a couple T3s left over. I tried those. Again, they just made me really sick, so it wasn't helping. So I was like, oh, I'm not taking those. So then I went to the dentist, and I went and got an x-ray, because I was like, oh man, look, I think I got a tooth knocked out. There's a big gash and it's bleeding. And the guy came back with the x-rays, and there's me and another guy sitting in the lobby, and he's like, so which one of you broke your jaw? And we both looked at each other because we're both getting x-rays. I'm like, I don't think I did. He's like, I don't think I did. He's like, Adam scored you? I'm like, oh, that's me. He's like, oh yeah, you broke it. He's like, see that gash there? That's your jaw split apart, right? And I was like, oh. And then you could see it when I bite down like that. You'd actually see it clink together. Go tink, tink.
That's got to be an eerie feeling.
I had a hairline fracture up. The weird thing is they left it like that for like a week before I could get in and get the surgery. Now I got all these titanium plates in my chin. So...
Real quick before we go, where can people find out, I guess, where they can find out more about your film project, your next film project?
I'm on Twitter. It's just Adam Scorgi, at Adam Scorgi, but it's I do Scorgi like score a goal with a big G.
Yeah.
As you know. So Facebook, you can Google me or go to the Union Facebook site. Those are the two best places to get me. I'm on those just about every day, checking, trying to keep up. And that's where you'll see the Kickstarter launch and my other project, Ice Guardians, if the NHL gives me the go. And it's the best place to get to track me down.
That's where I found you, was Twitter. And
yeah.
Netflix is where I watched that documentary a handful of times, and that's very popular on there. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who've watched it from Netflix.
Netflix has been a lifesaver for us. It's literally, it's kind of this cost versus reward with Netflix. People are like, man, like 9 out of 10 people ask, where'd you see it? Netflix. It's almost like you're not a real filmmaker till your film's on Netflix. And it's like, oh no, you're real. I saw your movie on Netflix. Like, you're legit, right? Yeah. Like, so Netflix is awesome. I mean, they don't pay much to filmmakers, but the exposure that Netflix has got is well worth it. I mean, it's pretty humbling when I go to a place and I get recognized. My wife always teases me because we'll go somewhere and some young kid will come up and be like, hey, I hate to ask, but are you the guy that's in the Union? And I'll be like, sure, man, but can I get a picture or an autograph? And I always feel, like I said, I feel like a fake. Like, I wish I had a copy of my film there. So I'm like, you don't want my autograph. Like, my autograph's not worth shit. And you'll say, oh, I got this guy's autograph. You're like, who's he? Right? At least if I had my movie to sign, it'd be like, well, I'm giving you something, like a material. But so my wife always teased me. She's like, oh, my husband, he's half famous. Wow.
Half famous.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, do you think the laws will change anytime in the near future? I mean, that's just a prediction. You never know. But do you think, like, the movement's in place? Or do you think there even is a movement?
There definitely is. And that's why we're calling the next one the Culture High. There definitely is a culture shift, right? Things are changing. Way more, you know, credible people are speaking out about this now. And I think the main thing, which is a big part of what we're going to talk about in our next film, is the access to information. Like Joe Rogan says often, he's like, I think it should be illegal that when somebody puts somebody in prison for information that is incorrect, that should be illegal.
Yeah.
right? When it's a click of a button away on your smartphone anywhere in North America, to be like, does this do this, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're regarding it to cannabis or anything else, and instantly you can get 12 studies that give you a good, unbiased argument that'll give you, they'll talk about both sides of the spectrum, and you can make a reasonable decision. That should be illegal, that then you then just go ahead and prosecute based on old archaic laws that were made, you know, back in the 30s.
Yeah.
Right? That seems crazy. So you'd like to think, but as we talked about in the union, right, the business behind getting high, is that a lot of businesses in place now over the years that are profiting off of the way the laws are now.
Even private prisons.
Private prisons, the Drug Enforcement Administration. I mean, even that was something that Norm Stamper, the former police chief, told us, that he's like, we would have a $2 million budget for the year, and we'd only get $1 million from the state. And they would say, okay, go make seizures of assets in order to be able to pay. Otherwise, you're going to have to lay off some officers, and you're going to have to cut people's shifts. So what did they focus on? It wasn't murderers and rapists, because you don't get to seize their assets. It was drug dealers, right? Which, that seems so backwards. Like, if there's anybody you should take... Rapists, right? You should take everything they own, right? You convict murderer,
fuck those guys.
Own everything, right? Like, you, a pedophile, you should be, if he's rich, fuck, you should own everything on his, you should be able to take the shirt off his back in the courtroom.
But
that's where, this is an ex-police chief saying how when he got in charge, he tried to change those things, because he's like, just looking from a rational perspective as a society, why is our budget focused on dealers when it should be focused on violent crimes, murderers, rapists, domestic violence, which often gets overlooked, which is something that he specialized in, because he said domestic violence is where you'd see the most wives and stuff get murdered, because we'd go there, it'd be the typical Ray and Sue getting into an argument, and we'd be so used to it that by the 10th time we go there, we're like, oh, we'll go talk to him, and this is the time that either the husband or the wife completely loses it and comes out fucking shooting and shoots the cops and shoots themselves and shoots them.
Yeah.
Right? Because we were always just like, oh, whatever, right? And, you know, when you're hearing it, like, you know, it's so interesting. We, all these people now with Twitter, you know, you get the pros and the cons. People on the internet now, they sit at home and they criticize it. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, okay, yeah, as you're texting me on your smartphone that uses, you know, conflict minerals from the Congo, and you're telling me I'm not doing anything about it. Well, neither are you, right? And then you have an ex-police chief who did this for 30 years, giving you insight, but somehow you still know better than he does. You know, that's some of the ridiculousness you get on the internet, but it's a way of anything, right? There's always pros and cons and conflict. So I think you are getting a shift, and it looks like things are moving in the right direction, but sometimes it seems to me just every time this gets in the right direction, then it takes 10 steps back. But I think now with the access to information being the way it is, I can't see how things don't change more and more every day.
I think that's a good note to end on. Hopefully it will, the information age will make a big change soon. But
seems to be. Hopefully it does.
Yeah. All right. I appreciate you talking to me, man. It was fun. It was... It went a lot better than I thought. This is one of my first interviews or conversations, whatever.
Yeah,
it feels
no problem.
Weird. It feels weird calling it an interview because it's not formal at all. I'm not sitting here with a notebook checking off questions or anything.
I think it's best that way, man. I've done a few podcasts, and I like just the bullshitting. And, you know, I usually when I do them, people will be like, okay, we'll do this for like, can we get you to sit down for half an hour? I'm like, I'm telling you, now that I've done a few, you'll stay 20 minutes and we'll do 40 minutes to an hour like that, right? Like, it just, they go quick. You get chatting and it blows by.
Hey, before we go, I want to share something with you. It's kind of funny. I printed this out. It was has nothing really to do with what we're talking about, although it does show how ineffective lawmakers are in Florida. This is an article someone emailed to me, but it was from late last year. It's about how there's a loophole where bestiality is still legal in Florida. Like, there's this same, it's the same guy, but he keeps raping farm animals. And he gets away with it because this loophole, it's not illegal. There's no actual law in the books about it. And so this is what it says. It says, the title of the article is Florida Lawmakers Poised to Make Third Attempt to Ban Bestiality. I mean, that's a joke right there, third attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it says, Lawmakers didn't want to debate the icky subject matter in public meetings occasionally frequented by children. First of all, how many children do you know are going hanging out at
city council meetings? Exactly.
But that's just sad. They'd rather just let this guy keep fucking goats than do their job.
Remember what I said earlier about politicians? Where a lot of time I think they're just lazy, like another job, right? Like when you work at McDonald's, you're doing just what you need to do to get out of there, maybe, right? Or you're working another job, even if it pays good and it's a good, respectable job. A lot of time you're doing just what you need. You're not going above and beyond, or maybe a little bit, but you're not doing everything you can, yeah, you know, to make it, unless it's your company, it's your ass on the line. So a lot of time I'm sure these people are just like, oh, we have so much to do today. Like, I really don't want to deal with that. Let's just put it under the rug and let's deal with something else, right? Like, that's exactly what we're talking about, is just people are just, until you get someone that, like, they're passionate about that, then they really push something through Congress, right? And
even as high as the national debt is in the U.S., they don't even take that serious. They're not doing much to lower that. Well, hell, marijuana being legalized could lower that.
Well, they probably look at it and they're like, oh my God, it's a headache. Let's just put some band-aids on it and we'll deal with it later. That's a good bit for you on stage, though, there, the bestiality thing. That's it.
Yeah, I've been holding on to that article for a while, so I should do something with it other than just read it on a podcast. It's pretty funny. I can just read this.
It's a good bit. I think you could make a bit out of that for sure.
I could probably just read it as is, and it'd still be a little funny. Just
that
it's taken them three tries to make something like bestiality illegal. It's pretty absurd.
But I agree.
It was fun talking to you, man. I appreciate it. I'll send you the link when the podcast is ready to go out.
Yeah, do. I'll put it up on my site.
All right, it'll probably be a couple weeks at the most, and then it'll be out.
No worries. Right. I'm no rush. I got plenty on my plate anyway, so.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
No problem, bro. Peace.